This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This being the first Compass to fall squarely on Independence Day, the Compass team decided to focus this week on two local institutions that have proven their worth in creating the kind of independence and resilience that has given Port Townsend a distinct local advantage in dealing with the global COVID-19 pandemic. First, Dave Cunningham talks with Jefferson County Emergency Operations Director Willie Bentz about the special challenges the pandemic has presented and how the EOC responded. And then, Chris Bricker talks with former Port Townsend Mayor and longtime Local 2020 leader Deborah Stinson about the role neighborhood preparedness groups have played in meeting the crisis. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
We're speaking with Willie Bentz, Director of the Jefferson County Department of Emergency Management.
It doesn't seem like anyone in the U.S. was fully prepared for this kind of pandemic, but your Department of Emergency Management is all about emergency preparedness. Did you have any protocols in place for this kind of situation before it started?
Yes. Yeah, so right off the bat, I will say that the United States was very unprepared for this pandemic, and that's something that both myself and my department have been kind of preaching for a long time, that we were really fundamentally underprepared for any major emergency. For a long while now, we haven't been devoting enough resources to emergency preparedness. The general public hasn't really been taking emergency preparedness as seriously as they could have. So, everything from this pandemic to a major earthquake to other major disasters, we've really believed we've been underprepared for. So this has been somewhat of a vindication of that message. And I really hope folks kind of take it to heart to start preparing more seriously moving forward. That being said, we did have a few protocols in place here locally in preparation for a pandemic. We do have a local pandemic plan that was originally put together by public health. A little over a decade ago was when that plan was originally written, I want to say. And our comprehensive emergency management plan is written in under a concept put forward by FEMA called All Hazards Emergency Planning. So the plan itself is designed to be adaptable to really any emergency situation, whether it be a pandemic or an earthquake or the like. So it's designed to be flexible, scalable, and really adaptable to our needs. So those two, kind of put us at a solid foundation to respond. But again, a long history of under-resourcing emergency preparedness, all that kind of stuff set us up to be underprepared and to really struggle to respond. I will say that historically as well, on top of that all hazards, emergency planning, that really only takes you so far. There are always, unique traits of different disasters. Obviously, an earthquake is very different than a pandemic, and so that all hazards concept only gets you so far. And we have been distracted by other, sexier disasters, so to speak, over the years. At the federal level, obviously, terrorism was a major focus, especially after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Centers. Locally, we've really been focused on a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and subsequent tsunami. So those specific hazards have drawn our attention away from something like a pandemic, those being a little bit more on the forefront. And, some folks have described this pandemic as a black swan event, something that we never could have seen coming. But really, a lot of pandemic experts have warned that something like this was inevitable. So it was something that we definitely saw coming, maybe got distracted by other more urgent or more relevant disasters, and that all hazard planning concept helped us. But again, the lack of the resourcing of emergency preparedness and a lot of other issues have kind of hampered our ability to respond overall.
Since this pandemic has started, what actions or activities has your department been involved with?
It's been a fairly wide wide range of things. So DEM, the Department of Emergency Management, not a lot of folks actually know this or quite understand this, but you know, I'm the only full-time staff person in the department. We have a couple of part-time staff who are grant-funded and help out with a number of different things. And our main role is to run the Emergency Operations Center, which is the central coordinating point for a lot of different agencies and a lot of different activities. And it's really kind of how we get all the folks involved in the response together at, you know, one proverbial table, so to speak, so we can coordinate and share resources and respond as a more cohesive unit. Some of the things that we've really been focusing on there in the EOC has been PPE acquisition and distribution, first response agencies, healthcare, etc. Our logistics team, this is just off the top of my head, has distributed about 70,000 pieces of PPE over the course of the response and has another 40,000 or so that's either in waiting, currently in stock, or getting ready to be distributed. Other than that, we've been coordinating with a bunch of different agencies and activities, everything from mass care to, you know, assist OVCAP, being able to safely shelter their residents, working within mass care to set up an isolation and quarantine facility for those who can't do so safely at home. Our planning section team has been assembling reports with data on economic stress and the stress on the medical system, and they've been helping to facilitate the planning process between all these different agencies. And then we have a joint information team whose job it is to, you know, craft messaging and point that out to the public. And then a finance section group whose job it is to, you know, track expenditures and ultimately help get costs reimbursed from FEMA and then disperse money like the CARES Act funding to relevant partners. So just a lot of different disparate activities going on, a lot of different groups involved. And at DEM, we've, again, kind of been the central touch point for a lot of that to help coordinate it all.
I am not surprised at all that you sound completely prepared for even the unknown in this pandemic. But can you tell us about some of the challenges that the Department of Emergency Management has faced or is still facing as it copes with this pandemic? Things that maybe have been a little difficult to overcome or to deal with?
Yes, staffing and resourcing has been a challenge. Again, not to, you know, harp on the point too hard, but emergency management and emergency preparedness has traditionally been understaffed and under-resourced. And I, you know, always would say that, you know, in an ideal world, every dime we spend on emergency preparedness ends up, you know, not being needed, and it goes to waste because we live in a world that's, you know, sunshine and rainbows and unicorns and nothing bad ever happens. But
yes,
when something bad eventually does happen, it's going to be a really great investment. And unfortunately, on a, you know, really a national scale, not enough folks have seen that and valued that investment. So we've been under-resourced in emergency management as a field. Public health, they're very reliant on grants. So for them to be able to, you know, resource up and respond appropriately has been difficult just because their funding is attached to so many strings. So our public health system on a national level has also been under-resourced, and that's been very difficult. Much like KPTZ, here at the Department of Emergency Management, we're heavily volunteer-based. And so, you know, that's been a difficulty just because, you know, we've been pushing volunteers into leadership positions, doing work that has been a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure for someone who's basically just helping out of the goodness of their own heart. So, you know, we've ran some volunteers pretty ragged, to be perfectly honest. And we've had a lot of outpouring of support from the community. But in a lot of these roles, it requires, you know, a lot of training, a lot of experience. And so, you know, our bench hasn't really been deep enough to staff certain areas sustainably. As with any disaster, they call them disasters for a reason, and coordination has always been difficult, making sure that everyone has the same information, is planning on the same page, especially as everyone's struggling to conduct their own routine business and focus on their department or their agency or what have you. Setting time aside to come to the EOC and plan collaboratively is always difficult. And then, just like with any other disaster as well, we've, you know, struggled to properly really get the message out to the community, which is, you know, one reason we value KPTZ's partnership so much is that, you know, you help pick up a lot of that slack and get the messaging out. And then you also provide us feedback back as to what else we need to focus on and what the community's talking about. So those are just a couple of the broad challenges that we've been struggling with, and we'll kind of continue to do so even as we patch things up.
Have you learned anything from this pandemic that might lead to changes in the way the Department of Emergency Management keeps itself prepared?
Yep. I will say probably the number one thing is that, you know, historically, we've always, when we plan and when we prepare, we would always plan and prepare with the assumption that, you know, technology would not be available, that that big earthquake would completely wipe the grid out, that that winter storm, we wouldn't have power or internet. And so there are certain segments of the emergency management community that, you know, are, hey, why even bother with computers and why even bother with fancy technology? It should all be pen and paper. We should just utilize the basics that we know are going to work, and we know we're going to work every time. But then during this disaster, we've had our full suite of technology available to us. We've had power, we've had internet, and in fact, we've been forced to use those technologies because we've needed the social distance. And, you know, historically in an EOC, you cram all the decision makers and all the leadership and coordinators all together in one room so they can work shoulder to shoulder, but obviously we can't do that during this pandemic. So it was kind of a shift in thinking for a lot of folks from, you know, let's make sure our technologies are redundant and resilient, and we need to focus on pen and paper if we have to, just starting to think about relying on technology even more and leveraging technology even more. So that's something we're, you know, currently in the process of doing, evaluating our technologies and the way we coordinate remotely, since that's something we hadn't placed too great of a focus on in the recent past, just because, again, we were expecting all that stuff to be wiped out, and now here we are in a disaster needing to rely on it as a crutch.
We're speaking with Willie Bentz with the Jefferson County Department of Emergency Management. What are the mechanics of emergency preparedness? And by that I mean, is there a standard operating procedure that takes hold whether you're dealing with an earthquake, tsunami, armed invasion, or viral pandemic?
Yes, so there's kind of a core response paradigm, a system called the Incident Command System, that was originally developed in California in the late 70s that allowed fire departments to work together seamlessly. So it was kind of a standard operating language and procedures to allow these fire departments to work together on any size fire in any jurisdiction, and they'd all kind of speak the same language and would know how they'd fit in with one another. In the early 90s, that incident command system became standard for all first response agencies in the state of California. And then in the early 2000s, it became standard for all first response agencies across the nation using what's called the National Incident Management System, or NIMS. And so we use the ICS, the Incident Command System, to respond to everything from a single family house fire. So if you see one of our local fire and EMS departments out front of a house, they're using ICS to respond to that event. And then it scales up to include, you know, fire and law and EMS and public works and, you know, our PUD and emergency management and KPTZ. This incident command system expands and adapts to be able to respond to something as large as a global pandemic. So we use that incident command system. We train all of our volunteers and EOC staff on it. And that's really the core mechanic we use in emergency management. And that's something, again, that's used across the nation thanks to NIMS. It's a national standard that if you want to be able to get support from FEMA, they require you use NIMS so everyone's interoperable. And then there are versions of it really used across the world.
Willie, do you have any sense of when, if ever, we can return to our old normal in terms of people being free to go to restaurants, baseball games, and fireworks shows without masks or social distancing?
Yes, unfortunately, it's going to be when there's a vaccine. And estimates on that, you know, a year, maybe potentially longer. And then there's the fact that, you know, are we ever really going to truly return to our old normal? You know, there have been some talk as to, you know, whether or not handshakes will still be a standard greeting once this all kind of blows over. So I think it's a question question of, you know, one, you know, when will we have that vaccine, and will we be able to, when will we be able to go out safely with no masks, no distancing? And then two, what will that normal actually look like? Are we okay with the old normal, or are we going to modify some certain behaviors to, you know, allow for, you know, even if it's not a global pandemic, even if it's the common cold and the seasonal flu, are we going to modify some behaviors to help prevent the spread of those diseases? Like one big thing for me is, you know, really encouraging folks, if you're sick, then stay home from work. And I know that that's difficult for a lot of people, so I'm really hoping to see some policy level changes that allows for that, you know, sick leave for everyone, because we really don't want folks coming into public spaces when and if they're sick. So, you know, a year plus for that vaccine, and then ideally we won't really ever go back to the normal as we know it. We'll be able to see some changes, modify our behaviors, and be more resilient, both for the next pandemic and for those diseases that affect us every year.
Well, Deborah Stenson is joining us on Compass, and she was born and raised in Colorado, and family eventually ended up in Oklahoma. And then, while in high school, she got the opportunity to train in computer technology, professional staff for the University of Oklahoma eventually, and she did work for banks. She worked with a small company called NetWise that bridged computer systems together. And later on, Microsoft bought the company in the mid-90s, and that triggered the move eventually to Port Townsend. And then, as I understand it, Deborah, you had a light manufacturing business of sorts?
Yes, I did. It never really fully launched, but I had a complete business plan, and I was in development, completed some prototypes, but then I kind of stalled out when I had trouble sourcing raw materials that I felt would be the most appropriate. And it was also something that I found I was being a little too isolated from the community I wanted to be part of. So I put that on the shelf.
Talking about a feeling of isolation, that didn't happen for very long. You got involved with the establishment of Local 2020. And then eventually you were on the city council, and then a lot of us remember you for the past 4 years as mayor.
Yeah, when I decided to get involved, I got involved, and I've enjoyed every part of it. It's been very enjoyable, and it's really why I chose Port Townsend, was for this sense of community here, and to be part of it and to be able to play such an active role has been a real honor and very rewarding.
And you worked hand-in-hand with Judy Alexander when you were launching Local 2020. And what's really interesting to me is that just the whole premise for Local 2020 is to work together for community sustainability and resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And then balancing all of those things that you need to balance, the economy, the ecology, the community. And one of your first initiatives through Local 2020 was reaching out to the County Department of Emergency Management's head, Bob Hamlin, in proposing to him that Local 2020 partner with the DEM to foster organized neighborhoods throughout Jefferson County. Now, that has certainly blossomed into something extremely important. Maybe you can talk to us about the evolution of that project and what were the obstacles? What was the importance? And where are we today with all of that effort?
Okay, sure. I'd be happy to. Yes, it was a real interesting. When we first started Local 2020, one of our other founding members, Catherine Burrill, was out at WSU at the time. And she was real proponent of mapping our assets before we jump in and try to solve problems. And it was during that mapping process that we identified the Department of Emergency Management, Bob Hamlin, as the real experts in emergency management, and that we would definitely need to partner with them to understand where we could best fit. And so this also happened about the time of Hurricane Katrina, and Judy Alexander and several other people coordinated a big effort to take on a sister city effort down in Bay St. Louis, another small community similar to ours, right on the coast, small, kind of not getting all the love that they needed during that time because of everything going on in the big cities around them. So Judy came back with her eyes wide open on the fact that we would definitely be pretty much on our own in any wide-scale event, and we better get ourselves prepared. So that's when we invited Bob Hamlin over to lunch at Judy's place. And very amicable. You know, I had no idea what to expect. You know, we're talking about very hierarchical system. This is Homeland Security, born out of the military, very structured environment, whereas we're a very flat organization, grassroots, organic, you know, just kind of figuring things out as we go. But Bob was very interested in what we had to propose. He did have a small grant where he had somebody on board trying to do community preparedness, but it was just one person and not full time at that. So he was very happy when we proposed a partnership, and it has been a true partnership. We could not have done what we did without the full support of the Department of Emergency Management. They are the experts in this field and know how to get things done. But then also they needed us as a partner to do all the community organizing. So that it's been a very fruitful and enjoyable partnership, probably one of the strongest partnerships in the whole Local 2020 history as far as working with a government agency. And it's, like I said, it's been very successful.
I have to tell you, Deborah, that I'm sort of an eyewitness to the synergy between the neighborhood effort and the Department of Emergency Management. They are so cooperative, and there are people there that are more than willing. I mean, you know, there's only so many people and so much time, but it just seems to me that they've been so cooperative in coming out to the neighborhoods, actually, during the organizing efforts in order to sort of help the grassroots neighborhood organizing efforts to help them sort of move along in the right direction. And I think that's really important. And I was involved in the organizing effort over in the Rosewood neighborhood for a while. And boy, I just can't say enough about the relationship that we have with them.
It's really something I'm really quite proud of. I mean, it's a real joy to have that kind of a working relationship with the people who are such experts in the field. So we did start out, and they helped us pulling together all of the different first responders, everybody thinks about, you know, not just emergency management, the fire department, law, Red Cross, everybody, you know, all the people that are going to come rescue us, right? And we had a meeting, and the message was, you know, folks, we have our tasks, we're very small staff, and this is what we're going to be doing. And it's not going to be driving up to your house and knocking on your door and seeing how you're doing, you know, for quite a long time. And so that helped spur a lot of people to action, to step up to be leaders for their neighborhoods. And then we started to put together our own little how do you organize a neighborhood program. And we were fairly well along in that. And then we discovered there was a woman at state level that was putting together a new program called Map Your Neighborhood. And it eventually, she actually let us kind of beta that here. And it's been our roadmap ever since. It's a really strong program that's gotten international awards. And it really helps neighborhoods come together in a really well-defined manner, but one that can be modified for any neighborhood to fit the character and size and needs of the neighborhood. So we've been doing that now for, gosh, a decade.
Right.
And we have, well over 100 neighborhoods organized throughout the county.
You know, the character, the size, and the nature of the neighborhood and all of that is pretty important. And I don't think that, well, at least I can speak from my involvement over in Rosewood, but I don't think that a pandemic was like paramount on anybody's list. And it was quite a curveball that got thrown at us in a very short amount of time. It evidenced to me what preparedness is all about, because all of the things that we were actually preparing for were related in some way in dealing with the pandemic. That was a big lesson for me.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I know over the years, Bob Hamlin and then, of course, now with Willie Bentz, we do a lot of training. Both incorporated the neighborhoods into everything they do. We're actually part of the whole city-county comprehensive emergency plan now. So we are active players in the world of planning for the county's response. And it's true, most of our training and tabletop exercises have been more around things like large earthquakes and major fires and things of that nature, which is very challenging if you think about the breadth of things you have to think about there as far as households being prepared, neighbors being prepared for, you know, having to have their own food and water for a long period of time, as well as you could lose communication. You could no cell phones, no internet, you know. So we always knew that there were other likelihoods and probably smaller events, but the idea is if you train for the worst, you're going to be prepared for everything, you know, the other things that could come along. And the pandemic is definitely a unique beast, but like I say, there's been the isolation and just the initial, you know, everybody stay at home till we figure this out. There were so many things we were able to do with communicating with our neighborhoods and our neighbors. We were able to get the word out right away, help be a conduit between Department of Emergency Management and the community, and then giving, you know, almost daily updates on things we need to be thinking about and considering. We were able to initiate a list of things you can do in your neighborhood as far as questions to be asking yourself and your neighbors and how to help each other, et cetera. And it turned out that a lot of, you're right, you know, having that extra food at home was great when everybody's a little too afraid to go to the grocery stores for a long time. We all knew each other. You know, Bob Hamlin used to always have this thing, you know, it's like the day after the event is no time to be exchanging business cards, right? That's he has these quarterly meetings where all the first responders and neighborhood leaders get together and get to know each other. Because a lot of what we're doing is just getting our neighborhoods back to where we're reaching out. We do know each other. We know each other's needs. We know, you know, contact information, but also strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, who are our most vulnerable among us? Who's going to need help under certain circumstances? So you just can kind of jump into action much quicker than if you just like, oh my gosh, I'm here all by myself. I wonder who lives over there and if they could help me or if they need help.
It all boils down, Deborah, to that whole concept of mapping the neighborhood, because it's so important to be able to identify special needs, people that are convalescing, people that are having medical problems, or the elderly. It goes all the way down the list. It's so important to be able to have that communication process right at your fingertips.
Right, and with people you know.
With people you know, the relationships.
Yeah, there's this trust element that, you know, that we always say, just start with a potluck, you know, if everyone comes together around food, it's a, you know, get to know one another. And then the information that's shared stays in the neighborhood. It doesn't go to emergency management or anybody else, you know, it's there in the neighborhood. So if somebody knocks on your door, they're going to be familiar to you, you know, or if they call you up. It is a very reassuring thing for a lot of people.
Deb, we have about a minute left. And I know it's, there's so much here. But if any of our listeners are really interested in, if they haven't done so already and they're not involved with the neighborhood organizations or the grassroots neighborhood efforts that we're talking about, what would they do? What would be the first thing that they would do? Who would they contact? And how would they go about getting
Well, there are a couple of things. They could go, there is the local 2020 website, which is l2020.org, and there's an emergency preparedness page there, and they can find neighborhood preparedness and find a lot of information there and links on how to get in touch. There's a map that you would find up there that you could actually pull up and see if your neighborhood is organized or thinking about being organized. And there's instructions for how to navigate that map up there. Or if you just want to reach out after that, if you're not sure about your organization or what else, anything, you can email just nprep@l2020.org. That's N-P-R-E-P @l2020.org. And we have a team that will respond to you, and they'll help you look at the map and find your organizer. Or if you're not organized, like you say, we have a wonderful team now of people that actually go out and train and help these neighborhoods get organized. So you're not on your own. Even though the motto is you're on your own, you're not on your own. You've got NPREP there to support you and the Department of Emergency Management.
Deborah Stinson, thank you so much for the work you do, the work you have done, and the work that you will do.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and I appreciate you getting the word out on this because it is an important project, and I encourage everybody to get involved.
This week's Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker, Dave Cunningham, and Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturday at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.